You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 6, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, BillMoyers.com, Mike Lofgren, whose piece on the anatomy of the deep state will be joining us. Meanwhile, perhaps the highest, the nominee to the highest office that has been rejected in the Senate yesterday, the Debo Abigile, nominated for Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, rejected by the Senate, including seven Democrats. A horrible story. Guy I actually went to college with. But that's not what makes it so horrible. Meanwhile, the Pope, did he just endorse civil unions? Poor Austin Ruse. And it appears now that not only did the CIA spy on the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee while it was searching CIA computers, but that the president may very well have known about this. Barrett Brown, standing trial and in jail right now for ostensibly, well, multiple charges. The primary one was the copying and pasting of a link online. That charge has been dropped. We will talk more about that later in the program. A lot of other stuff to get to. Ben Bernanke doing quite well for himself. But as we speak, folks, Chris Christie is speaking in front of a pack of rabid troglodytes chanting the words Benghazi and Fast and Furious. That's just my guess.
Don't forget IRS.
IRS.
I don't know why I found that so funny. It just, I think troglodytes, that just sold it.
And Governor Chris Christie is speaking in front of CPAC, I should say. I'm sorry. CPAC. I don't know what it stands for. Guys who are really excited about Benghazi. I don't know. And he is undoubtedly talking about trying to burnish his technocratic skills, but also talking about how horrible teachers are, how horrible unions are, how wonderful conservatives are, how much the liberal media is out to get him. And still, months into an investigation, still have not been able to frog march him out of office. But you should know that if you are in the general area, I'm not sure where they're holding this. I think it's in Washington, D.C. If you want to attend one of their panels, I would recommend the Healthcare After Obamacare, A Practical Guide for Living When No One Has Insurance and America Runs Out of Doctors. Now, of course, I don't know why one would need health insurance to pay for doctors if there were no more doctors. So head over there to see. That also could just simply be. It could be just some type of like poetry writing, learning annex class, too, or some type of kabuki. I don't know. Haikus, a practical guide? No. But there you go. The morons are me.
Healthcare, none. Black people, many. Scared I am.
Check out CPAC. I'm sure we'll have some sound from the insanity tomorrow on the program. I don't know who's invited or who's not, but they must be just freaking out about marriage equality there and God knows what else. I would imagine Benghazi. Last night I was on Chris Hayes' program talking about the notion that Benghazi somehow led to the Russian invasion of Crimea and that the solution to the whole thing, of course, is Keystone XL pipeline. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. In the meantime, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Mike Lofgren on the anatomy of the deep state. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program retired congressional staffer Mike Lofgren, whose piece Anatomy of the Deep State was published on BillMoyers.com. Mike, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
All right. So give us a, we'll obviously dig deeper into it, but give us in a nutshell, what is the deep state?
Well, we all know about the tendency of businesses to merge. This is the merger, what I'm talking about, of certain key sectors of big business with certain key sectors of government. When you think of the huge amount of contracting out and of the revolving door of personnel between government and business, this thing is almost inevitable. I mean, I became sort of intermittently aware of it during my government service, that there's really this visible government. It's the one you see on C-SPAN, takes place around the mall in Washington. And then there's a more shadowy and more indefinable government that the tourists don't, at the Capitol don't see. It's the one that really sets the compass heading for where this country's going, regardless of which party is formally in power.
I mean, is this what Eisenhower was talking about when he was talking about the military-industrial complex?
Well, it's partially what he was warning about, but the deep state is not synonymous with the military-industrial complex. I mean, that's a crucial component of it. It's also certain parts of corporate America that are not Pentagon contractors. Wall Street, which seems to have captured Washington and writes laws to its liking. Silicon Valley, which is an important component of the deep state because it produces all the high-tech stuff that enables the surveillance. And probably you could throw in the fossil fuel megacorporations, the big oil, because it's had a extreme effect on our foreign and national security policy for many years.
So, I mean, is this in your sense, a new phenomenon? I mean, obviously, Silicon Valley was not preeminent, let's say, 30 years ago. And frankly, I don't know that Wall Street really had the same measure of influence, across party lines or transcending party lines. Maybe it did. I mean, certainly corporate America has had this type of influence. But is this this relatively a new phenomena in your opinion, or are there simply aspects of it that are new?
Well, it probably started all the way back in World War II, when enormous government contracts were let to business for the arsenal of democracy. And then, of course, you had the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb, which had to be surrounded by secrecy. And it was an enormously expensive project. Now, that might have been the kernel of it. It has grown insensibly over the decades. Eisenhower was already warning about it 50 years ago. I think it sort of gained a critical mass in the 80s when you had this complete unleashing of Wall Street, so that it pretty much wrote the conditions of society as they wished it. Silicon Valley became a component in the 90s. I mean, people forget the CIA was spending venture capital in Silicon Valley, starting up a lot of these companies that got infusions of money. And of course, now these Silicon Valley moguls are pretending to be libertarians, but I think their own behavior suggests they're anything but. Now, probably the capstone of all this was 9/11. It sent the whole process into overdrive. That's why the decade of the 2000s was like the way it was. It's why we had color-coded terrorism alerts, how we had to be very afraid, how we ended up spending $1 trillion in Iraq, having invaded the wrong country. And also how Wall Street created its biggest and best bubble. All these things sort of culminated after 9/11.
And so wait, so are we talking about sort of a long, I mean, my sense of the, you know, what I've always perceived of the deep state is fundamentally, or has always, I guess on some level, been narrowed to the idea of the national security state, and that you see sort of a certain amount of momentum, even, you know, back during JFK's presidency, this notion of a real push, you know, specifically in regards to the Cold War, that there was an apparatus that preceded him that was pushing for a, in some instances, a nuclear conflict with the Russians, and that this apparatus, this national security state apparatus, has continued on and is aided and abetted. How is it broader than that?
It's broader insofar as now Silicon Valley is one of the main generators of wealth in the country and in the world. And it has become sort of joined at the hip. It is a necessary apparatus that all these technological innovations be brought out, because it is very useful to the deep state. It is not only the surveillance techniques of the NSA, but it is the avionics, the guidance systems of every weapons platform DOD has. Now, Wall Street is the ultimate backstop, because it is the ultimate wealth generator, and it pretty much creates the conditions and the necessity for the types of trade treaties that we have. The kind of forward deployments we have, which are essentially to protect vital areas of interest for investment. So I think it is broader than just the military-industrial complex. These people kind of set the guidelines by which the military-industrial complex acts. For instance, all the trade treaties are very good for investing capital overseas. They're not so good if you're a worker in Detroit or Toledo.
Right. And you know, when we the big story that broke, I guess, basically yesterday, and I think we're going to talk to Mark Mazzetti, who was one of the lead reporters on this, mid next week. But it was the Senate Oversight Intelligence Oversight Committee in developing their multi-thousand, I think, page report on the torture regime that grew up during the aughts and as perpetrated and overseen by the CIA was essentially spied upon by the CIA as they were in CIA computers as they were investigating reports of that. And you know, depending on how you read this letter from Mark Udall to the president seems to have known about it. I mean, is that an example of sort of this, I don't know if bureaucratic is the right way, but this institution within an institution that other parts of the executive branch can really only look at and hope maybe to ride rather than drive?
Well, I think that's a big component of it. It's an excellent example of it. It completely inverts the whole constitutional notion of congressional oversight of the executive branch. Now it is components of the executive branch on their own, basically being able to conduct their oversight over Congress, over the national legislature. And also, they have stonewalled the release of this report because it puts them in a bad light. They are essentially vetoing a committee of Congress duly chosen and sworn to perform oversight and do its own report from releasing that report.
And so give me some other examples that we see that are a function of the same dynamic.
Well, I think Bob Gates has made waves in recent months with his denunciation of the president and Joe Biden for not having the good grace to eagerly embrace his advice for escalation in Afghanistan. Well, he and David Petraeus and other generals, basically through a campaign of orchestrated leaks and lobbying on Capitol Hill, pretty much forced the president's hand on that, and against their better judgment, Biden and Obama accepted the notion of escalation in Afghanistan. In other words, how much in control of that process was the President of the United States, or was his hand forced? Now, that's not to excuse him. He should have fired some people if they were undercutting him. But nevertheless, it shows kind of who's really in charge here.
And so, I mean, how is, it's, I mean, President Obama had the option, presumably, right, to reappoint Gates. How does it perpetuate itself?
I think it does mainly in these sort of national security functions, but also in functions in the Treasury having to do with Wall Street. It's always the same people, and sort of regardless of party, you see the same types of people showing up. And of course, they claim to have no ideology, they're just public servants, but they really do have an ideology, which is the national security state when you're talking about the Pentagon and untrammeled free market capitalism when you're talking about the financial functions of the government.
And so, I mean, give me your perspective. I mean, what I found also interesting about your piece was sort of the perspective that you had as a congressional staffer, sort of a vague awareness of this, but also something in the ether, I guess, in Washington that makes it less distinct and more banal, I guess.
Well, we saw this both in the run-up to the Iraq War about how this thing just sort of had a momentum of its own, and we also saw it in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008. Obama came in with a clean slate and a mandate, basically, to put back in order what had been destroyed in the previous years. Somehow or other, Dodd-Frank turned out to be a lot more tepid than it should have been. Things like compensation limits for the CEOs of companies that got bailed out would have been an eminently good idea, but somehow that didn't happen. In fact, he had all these people around him, like Geithner and Summers, who go back and forth between Washington and Wall Street, telling him not to. And when I observed that, and also when I listened to Senator Dick Durbin saying in 2009 that Wall Street frankly owns this place, it seems the conclusion was obvious.
So, I mean, so what do we do about, and are there signs, I mean, when we have, is this a certain inevitability? Is this simply a function of money in politics? Is there something specific that can be done for this sort of narrowly tailored problem about the sort of unresponsiveness of our government to those of us outside of that deep state?
Well, there's truly so much money in politics, and it's coming from all these sources, that it is very difficult to change. However, I think in the wake of the financial crisis, more people are aware that there's something seriously wrong with government. It's totally unresponsive to the public at large, and the whole 99% 1% thing is, if you had talked about that 10 years ago, some people would have cottoned on to it, but not as many as now. I think there has been somewhat of a change in mentality, and oddly enough, I think the people like Udall or Ron Wyden are trying to shine a light on this. And ironically, you know, sometimes a stop clock is right twice a day. People like Rand Paul, whom I don't often agree with, he's right on some of these issues. And some of these Tea Party types, maybe their economics isn't what you and I would agree with, but a lot of them voted last July to restrict the NSA, and that vote came within about 7 votes of passage. So I think there is a more general awareness, particularly in the wake of the Snowden revelations, what's going on.
All right, so let me ask you, I mean, I know that you you obviously wrote extensively about this in The Party Is Over, how Republicans went crazy, Democrats became useless, and the middle class got shafted. But how did you go from from being a Republican staffer during, I guess it was during the Reagan Revolution, right? And
right,
so to speak, to sort of having this more populist perspective?
Well, I think seeing things down there at the granular level, if you have any sort of intellectual curiosity, and any sort of social sense of what's going on, it does make the light go on. But for that matter, have I changed, or has politics gone so gonzo in the last couple of decades that it's left some of us behind? I could probably, you know, be a perfectly in good standing Eisenhower Republican. After all, he warned about the military-industrial complex. But politics has really shifted in the last couple of decades, and that's simply a symptom of how far the deep state has advanced.
Well, I mean, from your perspective, I mean, this was happening while you were there. I mean, if it was the politics had changed, what was the catalyst for that change?
I think it was the gigantic infusion of money into politics. There was a kind of sea change in the mentality since the 70s in this belief that we just have to get out of the way for the job creators. And there was a kind of exaltation after the fall of the Berlin Wall that the United States could do anything it wanted abroad, the sort of American exceptionalism principle, that we were the good guys, we were always right, and we were there all over the world to vindicate right with a sword.
Interesting. Well, Mike Lofgren, the piece is The Anatomy of the Deep State. We will link to it at majority.fm. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed being here.
All right, folks. Before we head into the funner half, I want to talk about this Debo Adigbele story. Really, sort of, I mean, it's somewhat shocking, I guess. It never would have occurred to me. I guess I have not been doing my job in watching Fox News, frankly, to see how much they were demagoguing this. But Debo was a nominee to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. I went to college with him. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm not the only one saying this. And I was not, you know, I'm not particularly good friends with him, but I saw him most recently, I don't know, probably within the past year or so, at some alumni function. But he was the litigation director for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He had appeared at least on one occasion, maybe multiple occasions, in front of the Supreme Court arguing voting rights cases. He apparently a couple years ago, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund filed an amicus brief and then represented Mumia Abu-Jamal on an appeal of his death sentence for killing a Philadelphia police officer back in 1982. This appeal was not based upon, did not deal, I think, with his guilt or innocence, but rather the specifics of jury selection and jury instruction. That's it. And he worked for the National Legal Defense Fund. I think we should be saying the same thing, whether or not he was like of counsel at the time. He wasn't. He was, I don't know, probably 15 at the time of when Mumia went to trial. But the idea that representing anybody in court, I mean, I suppose you could have an argument if there was a guy who was sort of like a known, whose entire practice was representing mafia figure. But even then, look, this is the way our judicial system and our legal system works. Everybody is entitled to representation. It is the obligation of litigators and defense attorneys to represent their clients to the best of their ability. This was also a situation where the legal defense fund prevailed. So a higher court found that their contention was correct. So this is not just a guy going out on a limb here, but all of that to me is immaterial. The idea that that is what sunk his nomination. Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, who I guess this is still a big local issue in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania environment. And apparently a lot of police officers from Philly live in Delaware. And Coons wrote, "I embrace the proposition that an attorney is not responsible for the actions of their client."
Mighty noble of you.
Yeah, that's, wow, that is.
I embrace the basic understanding of all legal practice.
Of course, every Republican voted against this guy. And that was to be expected. You had Fox demagoguing this in a Willie Horton-style fashion, apparently, for the past couple of weeks. There were seven Democrats. Coons was one of them. The decades-long public campaign by others, however, to elevate a heinous cold-blooded killer to the status of political prisoner and folk hero has caused tremendous pain to the widow of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner and shown a great disrespect for law enforcement officers and families throughout our region. I'm sorry. I don't get it. There's no logic here. He's just got to be saying, Coons has just got to come out and say, look, I'm a horrible coward in this situation. I'm afraid of the political costs because of the efficacy of those on the right to demagogue this. So I am spineless, and I'm not going to expend any political capital on doing what is obviously right and correct. Mark Pryor of Arkansas, Joan Walsh of Montana. They're in a state apparently where Obama didn't do very well. They also should come out and say that too. I have no convictions whatsoever. Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, same dynamic. There were two others, I guess, Democrats. Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Manchin of West Virginia are the other ones. Understand, I don't think all of these guys were in the Senate at the time. Certainly the many of the Republicans were. John Roberts was confirmed after providing legal defense for a mass murderer. Free defense, pro bono. He was executed for murdering several people in Florida. Again, I don't think that should have been an issue whatsoever. But, of course, because Debo is not white, and because he's going on the civil rights division of the Department of Justice, it's much easier to demagogue. I mean, this is what we were talking about. Who was the guest that we had on a week or two ago when we were talking about the idea of demagoguing race?
Professor Ian
Haney.
This
is a perfect example of racial demagoguery in about five different ways. And it's a perfect example of the right demagoguing on this and some conservative Democrats, some Democrats who would have to answer, I guess, tough questions in Pennsylvania and Delaware, but how tough is it to say, you know, in this country, everybody's deserving of a legal defense. Their legal defense was validated by the court. This was not a wild-eyed political mission that the Legal Defense Fund was on, because the court upheld their perspective on it. So this was a very specific case of someone being denied their civil rights.
Well, go back to what Chris Kuhn said. That's so disgusting, because he's directly equating. There's this movement for a mumia, and he's basically just saying that that is totally indistinguishable from any type of legal counsel, period.
That's exactly what he said.
He ran in the opposite. Like, not only did he not do what you said, which would be the thing of integrity, he went out to out-demagogue the demagogues in his statement explaining his vote.
That's right.
It's demented.
It is demented. And, you know, in many respects, it's also indicative of the lack of political cachet that that the president has. I mean, this is what happens when you have a weak president and when you have one who is down in the polls. If Obama's poll rating was now 60 or 70%, at least two or three of those Democrats are not going to pull this. Nevertheless, it's an outrage. And then Heidi Heitkamp, in the height camp of hypocrisy. Heidi Heitkamp was one of the seven who voted to block Debo Adegbile, who twice defended the Voting Rights Act in the Supreme Court as part of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Twice defended the Voting Rights Act in court. Supreme Court. Was to be confirmed for the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. Almost maybe an hour or two after Heidi Heitkamp votes against this guy because he was involved in writing an amicus brief, and the defense, not even the defense, I guess, the defending the civil rights of a convicted cop killer whose jury instructions violated his civil rights. They won that appeal, so he went from being on death row to just life and parole. An hour after she votes against this guy because of that controversy, which I don't think is a controversy in North Dakota, frankly, she writes an email, a fundraising email, claiming that if there's one thing we should all be able to agree on, it's that every American deserves the right to vote. It's one of our most basic rights, but now it's under attack. She just blocked the nominee of a guy who argued in front of the Supreme Court on multiple occasions to defend that right. And she uses that issue as a fundraising appeal. Just the Heidi Heitkamp of hypocrisy.
Hideocracy?
The height of Heidi Heitkamp's hypocrisy.
Heitkamparocracy.
She's part of the Heitkamparocracy. Yeah, really just stunning.
So let's punish. I like this. Let's polish off that fundraising email after the boss shoots down this black guy for chief of civil rights division.
Yeah, probably after she shoots down probably one, arguably the most qualified person one could find in the entire.
Oh, his resume is amazing. I mean, in fact, the KC-1 for Mumia is a sterling example of being a tough civil rights advocate.
Right.
He literally got blocked. It's like, you can't be head of civil rights division. You're a civil rights lawyer.
Right.
I saw some of my old high school friends who I haven't spoken to in years who became cops all posting on Facebook right-wing links to block his
nomination
because of the Mumia trial.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was a big thing. I can't believe it. We just went over my head that it would actually happen,
yeah,
that it would actually get blocked.
Yeah, that was stunning. And, you know, part of it is I think there was also – I think a lot of people were sort of asleep at the wheel because after the filibuster reform – after the filibuster reform, where people presumed, like, you're not going to have to worry about Democrats voting for the president's nominee, there was just not the resources that was lobbying on this behalf. Nobody was providing any pushback. Really stunning. All right, well, we're going to take a break. We're going to head into the funner half of the show. The number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. Oh, remind me to talk about the lunacy. I was on Hayes last night with an energy expert, actually a pretty good guy. Daniel Dicker is his name, and he was a former, I guess, oil trader, independent oil trader. And I was talking to him in the green room. I mean, he did a very good job of communicating this on the show too, but I was talking to him in the green room, and he's like, I cannot tell you how absurd the notion that Keystone XL could in any way provide any help to this crisis, and the idea of us exporting natural gas to Europe is absurd because nobody wants to do it because they'll lose their shirts doing it. But we'll talk more about that in the funner half of the program, because energy policy.
There's a Sam Cedar fun half transition right there.
A laugh riot. Folks, your support makes this program possible. You members the other day, still getting over, you non-members, you freebies, still getting over that freebie, that teaser Tuesday. So join today at majority.fm. Do not be subject to the invisible hand of the teaser, the Tuesday teasers, which can strike really on any day.
It's more of a command and control hand, actually.
Is it? Yeah.
It's not very random. We choose it. It's centrally decided, and it could happen at any time. You have no power over it.
That's right. That, I guess, in that sense.
Czar Cedar.
With that said, the methodology in which we choose which day Teaser Tuesday happens is very random.
Well, Czar Cedar is a very erratic leader.
That's right. So it's based on an algorithm, and the inputs to that algorithm have to do with how much sleep Saul has gotten the night before, or allowed me to get the night before, and how much Myla is not screaming at the top of her lungs some pop song from Frozen, from the movie Frozen now. Yeah. Let it go. Let it go. 7:15 in the morning.
Oh, man.
At a decibel level. Tomorrow's a big day for me. It is the one year birthday of what's his name? Saul, my son, Saul.
That's an odd way to say it. Tomorrow's a big day for me. It is the 1 year birthday of my son, Saul.
Yeah, I've made it through the first year.
How about tomorrow is Saul's first birthday?
Yeah, that's one way of saying it. I've made it through the first year. I feel like I only have like five more to go before this kid can start to actually like taking care of himself a little bit. And Cliff will be joining us to celebrate. Oh, and hopefully we'll get Isabel Gillies.
Sounds like an appropriate time for an Isabel Gillies appearance.
Yeah, I think so. Housekeeping note. I will be filling in for Tom Hartman tomorrow afternoon from 3 to 6 p.m. on that, what's that device that's in your car and that you can actually dial and it goes, radio. That's what it is, on your radio tomorrow. Fair warning, I'm probably going to have David Dayan on to talk about the postal banking, but it will be just, it'll be a short segment. But I got to do it. Any opportunity I have to push that, I'm going to do it. And I know there was some of you who were very skeptical about, like, what's the chances of that happening? I've got my ways, folks, of pushing something.
That's why we're still in this office here for how many years now?
Well, that's the point is that that's not on my agenda.
That's kind of what I was going at, too.
Getting out of this small closet. That's not at the top of my agenda. However, folks, you can promote it by becoming a member today at majority.fm. Pennies a day brings you this show on a daily basis. You also can support this program by going to majorityreportkickback.com. It is completely free to you. It will take you 3 minutes of your time. If you buy crap via Amazon, go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always go through that link to buy your Amazon crap. We get a kickback. You notice no difference. But better than that, become a member. That gives us consistent support. And also, tell your friends. For gosh sakes, that's what that app is all about. MajorityApp.com, iOS or Android app. It's free. Members get the full archive of this show via the app. Something like 800 shows. It's searchable, too.
Members also don't have to worry about a surprise Teaser Tuesday.
That's right. Blindsiding you. And if you're a freebie user, I think you get up to like 2 or 3 months worth of past shows. Also searchable. So check that out. Give us a review on iTunes, folks. I haven't checked recently, but folks, we're falling down on the job a little bit. We need iTunes reviews push us up in the rankings. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920 is the number. Back in a minute.